Hello and welcome to Focus, the Catholic Answers podcast for living, understanding, and defending your Catholic faith. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. And one of the things we kind of have to understand, explain, and defend these days is the Christian person and the church as a whole in its involvement, in its where it's connected and where it's disconnected from politics. And lots of accusations. We hear newly minted words, at least they're newly minted as far as I can tell, like Christo-fascist being applied to those who even in some cases just think that Christian values should be brought into the public square and shared there or encouraged in voting and that kind of thing. So we wanted to talk about that. And in order to have a good conversation about that, we thought we'd get a lawyer and a theologian and a very fine apologist, Joe Heschmeyer. Hi, Joe Heschmeyer.
Hi.
Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
Are you a Christo-fascist?
I am not. I'm not sure anyone is. I mean, it's possible there are some people who are. The problem is the term doesn't seem to mean anything exactly.
It seems impressionistic, really, but there, there does seem to be. I mean, I would say, and I want to be careful about how I say this, but certainly there is a kind of fear of fascism. Mm-hmm. But there's also an active exploitation of the fear of fascism. So we have both things going on. And so just throw Christo with that. And now we're at fear of Christianity with it.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's an impressionistic sort of insult. You know, it's like feminazi. You're not going to find any self-proclaimed feminazis and Christo-fascists.
Oh, yeah.
It's mudslinging. It's a term used to deride another person's set of beliefs. And the problem is, because it's just an insult, it's hard to know what does that insult actually mean. Like, what are the tenets of fascism that you're claiming are in common with Christianity, or that this person is merging some Christian belief system over here and some fascist belief system over there? What does that mean exactly?
Right.
If by fascist you just mean they want to use the power of the state to advance or impose a certain vision of reality, well, then you can call everybody a fascist, because every law is in some ways the advance of a particular vision of reality.
Right.
If I think, you know, no one is responsible for their neighbor, you should be able to drive as fast as you want, I'm going to have one set of beliefs about what the speed limit should be. If I think everyone should be concerned about their neighbor, that there's a moral duty to take public safety seriously, including for strangers you've never met, I'm going to have a different idea about the speed limit. And whatever speed limit law gets set is going to advance one or the other of those visions of reality. So regardless of whether your vision of reality is informed or influenced by your religion, or whether it's coming from somewhere else, everyone has a vision of reality, one that their neighbor does not agree with in all its forms. And they try to impose that vision of reality in some way on society. And that's actually okay.
Yeah.
As long as you're respecting your neighbor's freedom of conscience. Freedom of conscience does not mean that nobody gets to win in terms of setting what the law is. It's never been the rule that, like, hey, you make a law for you and I'll make a law for me, because even that, a kind of anarchical understanding of the nature of reality, I would then be imposing that anarchy on you, which is the tremendous irony. So you just can't get away from the fact that all law by its nature is the imposition of values.
But let me step back before the law a little bit, because and first I now understand that you are a radical speed limit enthusiast.
I am something about speed limits, but I'll keep my cards close to my chest. I've avoided tickets pretty successfully.
But let's step back before law, because there is the thing about what constitutes acceptable discourse within society.
Yes.
And this is a pre-legal thing.
Yeah.
That the, you know, there's some things you don't do and some things you don't say. And in 1950s America, you wouldn't go onto the beach in the bathing suits that we regularly see on the beach in California now.
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not a matter of law, although you quite possibly could have got arrested.
Yeah.
For at one point, but the line shifts about what's acceptable, what's unacceptable.
Yeah.
And so it does seem to me that a lot of the frustration among many Christian people and of all stripes is the sense that our contribution to what is said in the public square is not welcome on, say, Twitter.
Right.
Is not welcome on Facebook or YouTube. Now, I think this is also exacerbated by the fact that certain purely secular things are also experiencing this this fight over where the line is. So can I say these vaccines might be dangerous? Well, no, you will literally be banned from YouTube if you say mm-hmm. that, even if you're a scientist, you know? So what can be said? What's welcome within polite mm-hmm. society? What's not welcome within polite society? And a media that seems to have assigned itself the task of policing these things. So do you want me to ask a question or do you want to just respond to that?
I can run with that a little bit.
Yeah,
because okay. I think I can tell you the stock answer people have who are imposing these really tight rules of conduct on society. And they'll say, oh, well, these are private companies. And that's true enough.
Sure.
The difficulty there is if...
Yeah, you go ahead. This Twitter calling. Whenever I talk about them, they do this. Sorry.
this is Cy's first time on the air.
Yeah, I've never done this before.
If there's no other way to spread your idea to a large group of people than using these platforms, and those platforms just say these ideas are not allowed here, you've been very effectively silenced.
Sure.
I mean, we talk about China censoring Google to cover up the Tiananmen Square massacre, and people are rightly outraged by that. They should also be outraged by us doing that about ideas in the United States.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter if it's the initiative of Google. We now know that they regularly meet with officials within the Biden administration, and this is something where the separation between the private company and the state is a lot thinner than it may seem. They're right. Beholden to the government for all sorts of things for their own smooth operation. They get a ton of money from the government. They could end up paying a lot of money. Things go the other way. They have a strong incentive to make the powers that be happy. And so then they're doing a lot of things that wouldn't be legal for the government to do directly. I think it's reasonable to say, that's something we should take more seriously than perhaps we do. But stepping back even further from that, the idea of what you're describing is what's called the Overton window. It's the window of acceptable opinions within a society. And it's not something legally enforced. It's socially enforced. Occasionally, it's legally enforced in a more like totalitarian state. But usually, it's that idea is too fringe. That idea is too out there. And so there has been an attempt to paint anything that looks too Christian as radical. As extreme.
Yes, this is what I'm talking about.
And so
I
think if you were to, you can see this in a political way. Just do a word count between phrases moderate left, moderate right, compared to far left, far right, and something like the pages of the New York Times. And you would think there's no such thing as a far left or a moderate right. It's really, and that's all intentional. That is not an accidental sort of thing. I was just reading something this morning. Italy, at the time of our recording this, just elected she describes herself as a moderate right figure. The headline said, this is the furthest right-wing leader since Mussolini. Like, directly drawing up the connection to fascism.
Yeah. Right.
They don't point to anything in her policies that are fascist. They don't point to any, Mussolini helped bring about the Holocaust. I mean, he helped deport Jews to concentration camps. It's a totally odious
and kind of Yugoslavia and Africa, and he's a mass-murdering maniac.
Mass murdering maniac. And so it would be like saying, oh, this person is, the furthest left Russian leader since Stalin. Or if you said, this politician, their ideology lines up with Ted Kaczynski. It's just that kind of personal attack of association as just an argument where you're not saying, here's why this idea is wrong. You're just saying this person is a bad word or this person is associated with somebody who's done bad things.
Right. It's almost like you're giving a narrative signal. It's just all it is a signal. It's
Absolutely.
Not even a rational thought. It's just a signal.
And so, the danger with doing that is that it actually undermines those guardrails. Yeah. If everyone to the left of you is a communist, or if everyone to the right of you is a Nazi, then when someone actually does have a radical, really extreme ideology, you've cried wolf so many times that you just aren't taken seriously. And so it's something that I think we need to take more seriously than we do, that just this constant name-calling, this constant invective, it really doesn't do anything to advance rational discourse. Because the other thing it doesn't do is answer the merits of the argument.
Right.
If all you say is, I'm going to call you a name, that person may say, I don't think that name applies to me. They may say, that name totally applies to me. But in either case, have you shown them why they're wrong other than to call them a mean name?
Okay, so we hear these terms now, Christo-fascist, and Christian fundamentalist is now used often to describe anyone who has any Christian sentiment at all. There is
which,
a problem.
By the way, like if anyone doesn't know the history of that, Christian fundamentalist refers to a movement within Protestantism that was pretty consciously in opposition to what they viewed as modernists, and especially people who believed in evolution. So applying that to Catholics who believe that you shouldn't kill unborn babies is like saying, oh, well, that Jewish person is a Shiite. Like, it just is kind of not, like, you don't know what you're talking about. You're just
from the Shiite branch of Judaism.
Fundamentalism refers to a group of Protestants. It just does. You can apply it and say fundamentalist Muslim, fundamentalist Mormon, fundamentalist whatever. But at that point, no one knows what you're saying. It's more smoke than fire. It's an impression rather than a definition.
Okay, so the here's the problem, though, that I said, and I want to stay away from law just for a minute, and we'll get into law in a second, and the relationship between the church and the way that humans make laws and government and all that. But okay, so I gave the example of the vaccines. Mm-hmm. That concerns me because I do think we need robust debate about things. But I feel personally attacked when the Christian who holds normal, everyday, traditional Christian views of human sexuality is a monster on Twitter. Like I've known personally people who themselves or their ministries were banned from Twitter, mm-hmm. or were not allowed to collect funds anymore mm-hmm. from what's that?
Patreon or PayPal.
I think it was PayPal. Okay. Yeah. Or even Wells Fargo. I remember deplatformed a person who said something I thought was quite normal because it contradicts a kind of fundamentalism about homosexuality, about transsexuality, or about even about divorce. Mm-hmm. That these things are sacred in a way that you're not the Christian who holds what Jesus held, for example, and what Jesus was quite public talking about, is a monster now. So that they can't even bank. They can't even. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. I mean, not just the Christian who holds what Jesus held, but if you have the position on gay marriage that, say, Barack Obama held in 2008.
You are now like, I hadn't thought about it, but yeah, we don't have to go back to Jesus. Just go back to Barack Obama 2008.
Yeah, I mean, I'm struck by this because I remember in the early 2010s, someone saying basically, if you don't believe in gay marriage, you're a horrible bigot and there's no other excuse for it. And I asked him, I was like, well, what do you make? You've supported, I've been friends with you long enough to know you voted for Obama who held these things. You were okay with voting for someone despite obviously disagreeing with him on this issue.
Can I ask you, do you think that there's a certain, yeah, but we knew he was lying when he said that.
There may well be, but there were a lot of other people who weren't lying. I mean, he's young enough.
I'm not saying that he was lying. I'm saying that
the person just assumed
Obama's lying about that to get elected. I'll ignore it.
Yeah. I think it was kind of a consensus that he may not be telling the truth about that particular issue.
Yeah.
But a lot of other politicians, I mean, if you look at, you know, President Biden back when he was Senator Biden, he wasn't like some really woke radical left winger in like the 70s. You know, he was not super pro-choice. He was more or less, you know, seemed to think he was pro-life and voted for the Hyde Amendment. He wasn't pushing a radical gay agenda. You know, none of those things were there. And so it really is this issue of if you can't hold the belief that person held before without being just run out of society, there's something really alarming to that. Like, you can't believe what your parents believed. You're required to believe a whole new set of beliefs about reality upon pain of like social ostracization and exile. That is something that we are using that power really much too easily. This is something, you know, I understand there are some ideas that are really out there, and I understand why people exile certain ideas, so to speak, especially something like, you know, people promoting Nazism. But to just say, yeah, marriage seems to have something to do with babies, and babies are made from a man and a woman, and it makes sense that marriage has something to do with being a man and a woman. It, like, that should not be in the same category of, I want to exterminate 6 million people. Like those should not be in the same category of unacceptable for society sort of thoughts.
No, and you think that the person who puts them in the same category is a maniac. But if you thought that, then you think most of the mainstream American media is maniacs. Much of American academic is – like if you call that a maniac idea to think, well, a Nazi is the same as a person who believes what Christians traditionally believe about marriage – if you say that's a maniac idea, you're indicting many of the leaders of American society.
Well, I think we can even go maybe a touch further. That if you really want to talk about a totalitarian belief system, it's this idea that I can change what everyone has to believe on, you know, Wednesday, and then Thursday I can change it again. And if you still believe what we believed on Wednesday, I'm going to run you out of here. That is not the way real thought and ideas develop. Things don't just change on a dime like that. That is much less like people have been convinced and more like people are just afraid to say anything else because they know what they're supposed to say. I think we see this very transparently with transgender issues, quite frankly, that if you take this one issue, you do a gender reveal and people kind of know, oh, yeah, maybe life begins at conception or at least sometime before birth.
I know.
And maybe there's already a gender. But then if you get them on page where they're talking the talking points, they'll still say, oh, the gender assigned at birth. It's like, you know the gender wasn't assigned at birth. No. You were celebrating it 4 months earlier.
Right, exactly. We've got you on tape with the gender reveal. Exactly. Yeah, you had pink confetti.
It wasn't assigned. The parents weren't just like, I guess we'll call it a boy. It's like, no. The doctor showed you something medical, like a sonogram. And then you knew.
Yeah.
Those kind of things, people know better, but they've just been so acclimated to not speak the truth, to just say the socially acceptable thing. That is much more like the actual situation of fascism. If you know anything about history, the Catholic position of like, you're made with dignity and you should be treated with dignity and your neighbor should be treated with dignity and there's some truths about reality and you shouldn't deny those truths. That's not fascism at all. This is the really kind of tremendous irony to all this. George Orwell has an essay on the Spanish War. Well, he's looking at Franco's kind of rise to power. And one of the things he talks about is that the fascists, the actual real life fascists, made war on objective truth and said there was no such thing as objective truth. There was just German truth and Italian truth. And so they had turned everything into like your ethnic or your identity politic group. And so what we now call identity politics was actually pioneered by the fascists, but it was actually pioneered by the early Nazis. And so now anyone who dissents from that kind of vision of reality and says, no, it doesn't matter your race or your creed or your sexual proclivities or anything, there really are fundamental truths about reality we cannot deny. The perversity and irony of calling that person a fascist is staggering. I mean, it shows a total lack of awareness of history or total misunderstanding of what the actual odious ideas the fascists and the Nazis actually taught were, because it's being deployed, the insults are being deployed in defense of a system that actually looks a great deal more like the seeds of fascism.
Right. Okay, so let me propose to you a theory I have about some of this extreme language, including Christo fascism, being applied to people who say things like boys are boys and girls are girls.
Yeah.
You know, that this shocking language of oppression involved in saying a boy is not the same thing as a girl. It seems to me, and I'm curious what you would think of my theory, that if you said to a person there was, starting in the 1920s and reaching its absolute apex around 1968, there's been a sexual revolution that has been ongoing. And when we look at the condition of society today, all of the objective evidence is that that sexual revolution has been an utter failure. So that the project of marginalizing those who want to speak about it is simply a project now of panic that people are going to notice that none of this worked.
I think it depends what you mean by worked, because I think the sexual revolution worked extremely well for the Harvey Weinsteins of the world. I think it worked extremely well for the Epsteins.
If you want to be a rapist, this is the greatest society in the history of the world.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe
the exploitative, powerful men who really pushing. I mean, think about the work Weinstein personally did to advance kind of the vision and attractiveness of the sexual revolution with the film to his bankrolling.
Yeah.
The guy is directly benefiting off of a particular view of reality and promoting that really aggressively. And it makes sense that, of course, you know, people could quietly have their suspicions, but they couldn't say anything publicly. Likewise, people could say more broadly, maybe his vision of reality was bad. And they can quietly have their suspicions, but they can't say anything publicly, because in both cases, you could lose your job, you could be run out of town, you could really be humiliated, and so on.
Right.
And so there really is, I think, a connection that there's a small group of people who benefit tremendously in this life. I mean, it's costing them their souls, so it's not benefiting them long term, but benefit in this life from sexual revolution, easy availability of consequence-free fornication and adultery. And everybody else suffers. The kids, the people who get used by it, especially women who are not as powerful, and, you know, all of everybody else suffers for the sins of these powerful men. And we're supposed to just be quiet and not ask questions about it, because if we ask questions, that's fascist. And again, it's like the perversity, the great irony of calling that the fascist part is not lost in anyone who understands fascism.
Yeah. Okay. So, I do think it's a this is where I have hope. I do think that this is a delaying tactic and that people will wake up. There will be a revolution that is a just so basic. That is to say, family is good, children are good. And I think it may only even be a small part of society, but it will be a very healthy thing when people go, nope. That was a mistake. The 20th century's view of sexuality promoted by the media and abetted by academia was a mistake. And we have to – and people, I believe, will come to say it quite openly and in fairly large numbers. Nope, that was a mistake.
We're seeing that in some quarters, and some quarters we're not. And I think we're seeing it almost on an idea-by-idea basis. So, yeah. I mean, I've – my optimism on this is tempered, and my optimism is tempered in a few ways. One of those ways is that, you know, I'm blanking on who said it now, but there's someone who said that the American economic system is run on the idea that all of the working class are just temporarily embarrassed millionaires. And so you'll have these, you know, legal and economic schemes that really favor the rich and that are supported contrary to the economic interests by poor and working class people, because they think, well, if I ever get to the top, it'll be really nice not to pay taxes on that. Or it'll be really nice, yeah, not, you know, that sort of thing. Well, in a similar way, I think a lot of the sexual ethics is built on the fact that, you know, we're just temporarily embarrassed playboys.
Yeah.
That, you know, well, if
right,
if I ever become rich and famous, I'd like to have unlimited, you know, like, yeah, all of that
consequence-free
stuff. Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people supporting the sexual revolution are directly harmed by it. And maybe in ways question. That they don't even realize.
Well, many women now are giving that testimony that,
yes,
I was part of hookup culture. That is a horrible abuse that I voluntarily signed up for.
Well, voluntarily in a way.
Yeah, right? In a but sense, right.
Let me draw the analogy between the economic and the sexual sphere a little more obviously. When Walmart comes into town, everybody else has to lower their prices or go out of business. And so when the sexual libertine comes to town and starts going after the same person you're attracted to, you got to lower your standards or go out of business. Richard Stith explores this idea of what he calls the sexual marketplace. And basically, human interactions aren't that different, whether we're talking about sexuality or economics, that people respond to what's the expectation.
And so expectation the value of a woman literally goes down.
Absolutely.
I see what you're saying.
If before it took marriage and it took a certain caliber of men, it took a certain, you know, all of these expectations.
Right, you
have
to at least
before.
Be decent to me.
Like, right. Like, it goes from that to like the shotgun wedding era, where maybe fornication is kind of, you know, it's not done just casually, but if you've got a steady boyfriend, then maybe it's more acceptable. But if he gets you pregnant, he's got to offer you marriage. That's a worse situation than the one before. But then after you get the sexual revolution, you get contraception, you get abortion, even if he gets you pregnant, well, that's your fault for keeping the baby. You should have had an abortion.
Yeah.
And so in every stage, a woman's value, what she can ask for from a husband, from a partner is
lower and lower, lower and lower
and lower and lower. And, lower. And yeah. So even saying husband there is a little anachronistic, because it's right. Now just like, well, what can you get on the app? And chances are you're not getting Prince Charming.
Right.
That's kind of the move. And it very much is the move of something like Walmart comes in and then Amazon. And then in both cases, you're competing with this app that's just pennies on the dollar, and you have very little you can demand for quality, and very little you can, you know, they all that you're competing suddenly with the whole world in both cases. So and that's a very hard situation to get out of. I think most people could recognize, you know, Amazon's not been good for small businesses, and it's destroyed a lot of communities, and like the main street doesn't look like it used to. But getting them to stop using Amazon's really hard because it's super convenient. I use Amazon, it's super convenient.
Yeah.
And even though I know in some ways it is contributing to the destruction of things that I really savor about, you know, the local community and small businesses and everything else. Well, likewise with sexuality, that people can know Tinder and the rest are not helping. They're not making it a better situation for families and marriage.
But what are the options?
Romance.
Now?
But yeah, yeah. And so it becomes very difficult to say no to that. So that's one reason I kind of temper the optimism. But nevertheless, I think there are some bright spots on the horizon, and they're from some surprising quarters, because I think women are starting to speak up more and say, some of this stuff is just gross. If you go back and even watch like movies from 10, 20, 30 years ago, you'll find things in there that you would never see in a movie today because they're just so grossly objectifying or, you know, hyper sexist. That sort of stuff, there's been some pushback on, and this is a one of those weird places where the Catholic Church and a lot of like feminists are kind of on the same page saying, yeah, treat women with more dignity. Or even like the Me Too movement. I know it kind of ran its course, but it really was women standing up and saying, I did not like being treated like that. And consent alone was not enough. This was still exploitative. This was still not in keeping with my dignity. Now, they had oftentimes a different way of kind of framing that question. But in both cases, the church and these women were calling out, it's not good enough. You cannot just say two consenting adults and have that be the end of the discussion. Because so often it's more complicated than that, and you can really get hurt that way.
Yeah.
And something more is needed. So I don't know. I don't see an overnight or even maybe in our lifetime shift towards the sexual revolution at its core was wrong. I think that too many people are invested in it. And they don't see an alternative, or they're afraid that the alternative is somehow fascist.
Yeah, they're afraid to. And that's the thing is, I think there's a certain way in which you are encouraged to think that some thoughts are right thoughts and some thoughts are wrong thoughts. And it's not that they're going to put a rat cage on your face and let the rat, you know, like they did with Wilson or what's
right, in 1984.
But it's just that they're going to make you feel bad on Twitter. So you try really hard not to have the wrong thoughts. And among the wrong thoughts is like things like marital fidelity are actually good for both men and women, and especially good for children.
Yes.
I do want to turn to law for a minute.
Okay.
Okay, so because among those who are called Christofascists are the five, or is it six?
Five and a half.
Catholic judges who voted for Dobbs' case.
Mm-hmm.
I do think this put people suddenly woke up to the fact that the Supreme Court is very, very Catholic right now. It's the most Catholic it's ever been. Roger Taney was the first Catholic on the Supreme Court.
A disgrace. Dred Scott.
The author of the Dred Scott decision was the first Catholic. And so people were like, we don't need any more Catholics for a long time. Yep. It's been a mostly white male Protestant office, as have most of the offices of the United States. Ben.
Well, Kavanaugh now goes to an Anglican church.
So he is
the only representative of white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism that's the court at all. Everybody else is Catholic or Jewish.
But just before we started recording this, I was playing you some audio from Elie Mystal, who I always go to because he uses very frank and extremely left-wing. As a matter of fact, probably he's the most left-wing person since Stalin. Just kidding. Exactly. But that's a joke, Elie Mystal. But he was calling them Christian fundamentalists, the Catholics on the court.
Which again, makes no sense if you know what those words mean.
Yeah, they're not Christian fundamentalists, but there is this sense of who are these people, these Catholics, to rule over us? You get this, and I hate to say it, but that has a very American feel to that anti-Catholicism. The implied anti-Catholicism is we can't have Catholics running things. Right.
Yeah, there's a reason why Article 6 of the Constitution bans religious tests for public office, because the founders knew. Already by that point was this deep-seated sense of like scared, I don't like your denominational affiliation. I don't like the fact you're Catholic. I don't like the fact you're Jewish. I don't like the fact, you know, whatever. People were going to make these decisions based upon lines of bigotry rather than anything like a principled position. I mean, this is the thing that's so ludicrous, so absurd, is, oh, they're just imposing their Catholicism on the rest of us. Like, read the actual opinions. Where are they citing the catechism? Where are they making some appeal to special revelation or to anything that isn't just clear law? The question before them was basically, is there a constitutional right to abortion? If you know anything about the Constitution,
there's clearly not. They're not. Right.
And, you know, maybe you think there should be. Whatever, we can have that discussion. But is there? No, there's not. And for a long time, the court pretended there was, and it was paper-thin reasoning, and even a lot of pro-choice people realized it was a bad constitutional law decision. Even if you think it's a good policy, if you don't know the difference between Congress and the court, that's an important distinction. You can say, I think this should be the law, I think the Constitution should say this, but it doesn't, and it's not the court's place to change that. And so whether you love or hate abortion or somewhere in the middle, the truth of the matter is there was never a constitutional right to abortion written into the Constitution. Then you couldn't reasonably draw one out. And the legal arguments for why there ought to be one or ought to be read as one were so bad that one doesn't have to even be personally pro-life to say, yeah, there's not a constitutional right.
But
and that's all they did, by the way. They didn't outlaw abortion in America.
But there
they
are real said, world consequences to The Nation and MSNBC and Elie Mystal and folks in that of sniffing at these Catholics.
Yes.
Because people then attacked Catholic churches, attacked other Catholic institutions, including pregnancy help centers, which are apparently now the most evil thing in the universe. Now, if you help a pregnant woman – then you're really bad nowadays.
It's so bizarre. It's so crazy. It isn't like they're kidnapping pregnant women. It's like they're saying, yeah, you have to stay here and we're not going to let you go get that abortion. Yeah. Women who want an alternative to abortion, which every pro-choice person in the world should support crisis pregnancy centers. If you actually are pro-choice and not just pro-abortion, you should support crisis pregnancy centers to offer an alternative.
It's a choice then.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, if I say I want choice in my fast food options and all I want in town is McDonald's, then I don't believe in choice.
Yeah.
I just want one option.
It's just this kind of perseverating where they say, well, it's a lie if you say that that's a baby, you know, that a pregnant woman has inside of her. And that means that these people are lying to pregnant women by saying you're pregnant with a baby and we can help you. You know, any kind of trying to convince them. See, now you're a liar, and this is all demonstration.
It is this incredibly condescending view of women. The same people who say trust women are also like, well, you can't tell women that fetus means baby in Latin because women are so simple they won't know what to do then. And it's just like, come on, this is ridiculous. Do you believe women can make informed decisions or not? And I understand, like, by all means,
not. I think the answer is not.
For them or for you? That?
No, not for me. I mean, for the people who are saying that.
No, it really is this. You can't give them too much information. You can't have too open of a conversation, or some women will not have abortions, which is, of course, it's true. There are people who make decisions in the heat of the moment in a really emotionally volatile time. And if you just give them, like, you know, waiting periods, for instance, waiting periods decrease the number of abortions. Just like waiting periods with guns decrease the number of gun deaths, because sometimes people in the heat of a moment
to think it through
life or death situation without thinking it through. And it really helps to say, take a breather.
Yeah.
And then we'll talk. That doesn't mean I think in either case you should, you know, kill someone after you've had that waiting period. But the fact that you have these things, and so, yeah, they see that crisis pregnancy centers decrease the amount of abortions, and they think it must be because of trickery or something.
Yeah.
And it's not. It's because people do better when they actually contemplate their decisions.
Well, okay. Well, so let me get to where I wanted to get to now about the real genuine – I mean, we're so deeply divided, and there's deception on both sides about what the other side actually says, and but there is a movement that uses Christian symbolism in America that's always been there. You know, I can remember back even in the 80s. I think it was the 80s. It might have been the 90s when there was the skinhead movement, which was a racist movement that used Christian symbolism. I would think today the skinhead movement is more respectable than it was back in the 90s. And so it's fair to say there is a growing movement of – or there are growing movements in the United States that are attaching themselves to Christian symbols and maybe even thinking themselves as Christians that are quite racist, in some cases quite anti-Semitic, although the secular anti-Semitism is also quite a fright but these days. But lucky Jews, both sides. But what I'm saying is it's not just a fantasy of these people, that there are people who are...
That's totally fair.
Okay, so
there are people who flirt with a sort of, maybe Hitler wasn't so bad, Nazis weren't so bad, fascism sort of thing. And they are often very good at saying just enough to kind of hint at where they're going with that without ever just saying that part, that maybe Hitler wasn't so bad. Yeah. And so, I mean, we saw this especially, say, 6 years ago. You had the whole Unite the Right. You had all of that stuff where there were very clearly people who were involved with white supremacy, with the, you know, all of that kind of odiousness. And the response to them is the exact same. Vitbrindor Zorge, right?
With a burning conscience or a burning heart.
Right. Pius XI, where he just says, don't make a god of race.
Yeah.
And so if you're thinking the most important thing about you is your race, whether that's white or black or anything else, you've already missed it. Something more important about you exists, which is that you're a beloved son or daughter of God. And if you think the most important thing about the person next to you is their race, you've already missed it. That doesn't mean race doesn't matter. It doesn't mean politics don't matter. It doesn't mean sex doesn't matter. It doesn't mean any of those things don't matter at all. It might really help form your story. It might be part of your narrative. It might be part of who you are and kind of your experiences. And, you know, a white Catholic and a black Catholic have different experiences of daily life. I take that as almost axiomatically true without that being the most important thing about either of them. And so the response ought to be a properly Christian kind of anthropology, which is we're all sons and daughters of Adam. More importantly, we're all sons and daughters of God through baptism, and treat one another in that way. And so if you aren't treating the other person as someone for whom Christ loved so much that he would die for them, you've missed it. You're really at odds with what it is to be a Christian. And that includes the person who is most against you, right? Like Ephesians 6, we're not contending against flesh and blood, powers and principalities. So if you're contending against flesh and blood, whether that's another party or ethnic group or sex or whatever, or you've missed it. That's not it. That's not the Christian thing. So get back on course.
Well, but here's the problem where this, I mean, Satan's very good at his job, you know? Yeah. And like you remember.
Not sure the job is, but yes, it's more of an occasion.
He gave himself a vocation. Yeah. No, it's not a vocation. You can't say it's a vocation.
Not a vocation.
No.
More like a pastime.
Pastime, but the past eternity. But the you saw the Atlantic magazine a few months ago with the rosary is a Christian, Christian symbol. Here's the problem with all these connections that the media is making is – well, if you put my thing in with those people, I'm going to be honest with you, that makes me think, well, were you telling me the truth about those people, or should I look into these Christian fascists?
Because
maybe
this is
they're not
the
so bad.
Wolf phenomenon.
Yeah.
If they say, you know, Catholic answers in such and such group believe the same thing, or they're speaking like condemning us in the same voice, without knowing anything about such and such group, I'm like, oh, cool, they're on our team. And
yeah.
They may not be. They may be diametrically opposed in pursuit of something really demonic and kind of their vision of the human person.
Right.
But this is why that kind of campaign of smearing people and just labeling them with negative terms and all this really is not helpful, really is not how it's done. That you should answer the actual error being made, and just the politics of insinuation and association and name-calling – that's not how rational debate is held.
Yeah.
Because so often, I mean,
and you might feel really smart doing it or clever or something, but you're making things worse.
Yeah,
for your own
actively,
side, you're making things worse.
Yeah. And it gets a lot of clicks, you know? You'll probably make a little money off it.
Right.
But you're going to actually make the whole situation worse by misinforming people, by alienating people, by radicalizing people in a way that's really unhealthy and unhelpful.
The country seems to be in some ways disintegrating. It's in a state of moral disintegration in many ways. It's in a state of media disintegration in the sense that I have my media, you have your media. There's no –
you have basically NPR for anyone who listens to the show.
NPR and Ellie Mastal. Those are the only two people I watch. How should a Catholic now – and I'll end with this question. I really won't bother you with any more questions. But how should a Catholic now – behave politically.
True.
Do you see what I'm saying?
I like that you give me a nice, easy softball at the end there.
Yeah. Because part of me really just wants to give up in a certain sense. I have to be honest with you. Yeah. This be like Benedict option. And I know I'm kind of trivializing what Rod Dreher did. And I'm a great admirer of Rod Dreher. I'm not, even though I know he's Christo-fascist.
I'll stop. I'll stop before you get any worse on this.
Okay.
I'm just not trying.
I'm just trying to pick on anybody. But you. But you know the basic categories of options, and you got the one option is the Benedict option, which now people kind of shorthand for, you know, move and away from society, and then you got the Francis option, and you got all these other options, and what's the.
Yeah, it's a good question. Because I didn't even mention this before. One of the delightful bits of irony about the invocation of fundamentalists in this pejorative sense is that the real-life fundamentalists were largely retreating from society. They viewed American society after the Scopes monkey trial and all that as basically irredeemable. And so they just said, we'll work on our own house. And it really isn't until like the religious right, the late 70s, early 80s,
that they kind of
reemerge.
Oh, yes. I hadn't thought about that.
So one of the major historic markers between like an evangelical and a fundamentalist was that evangelicals were way more engaged with the culture, where fundamentalists would form these kind of weird enclaves that were just trying to keep pure from the ravages of society. So they weren't about trying to impose their vision on America. They were trying to keep America from imposing its vision on them.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was just very much this, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord kind of mentality. So that's just as an aside.
I have to say that is a very tempting approach. I think that
approach gets right is this. Put not your trust in princes, the Psalms say. Yeah. And so if you're expecting salvation to come about through politics, it's not going to. And one of the easiest idols to fall into is political power. And it alienates people from the church way more than it draws them in. By all means, I think the secular order should respect and promote natural law. And in doing that, by creating a saner society, it becomes easier to evangelize. People do less damage to themselves and the like. But if we think our job as the church is basically just to get people to vote a certain way, we have replaced Jesus with Caesar, and that's not going to work. It's worse than not going to work. It's a disaster spiritually as well as politically. And to that extent, I agree that that's something to be on guard against. We should have laws that are good laws, but if that's where our focus is, that's a problem. Second, a lot of this will be in enclaves. You know, bad company corrupts good morals. St. Paul says that. So you want to build up good networks of like-minded Catholics. If you can, find places where your kids can grow up with good, solid Catholic families and kids. It's not going to be perfect. Those kids are still going to be sinners, and your kids might still get into trouble. But the more they have good role models, the more they have people they can peers and role models they can look up to, the easier it is to raise them in the faith. But three, we are called to be a light to the world. And so in doing that, we can never just close that door. That if you look at the spread of early Christianity, a lot of it was you had these Christian networks, Christian families, Christian kind of kinship, you see what I mean? Like a social network of Christians who were incredibly invitational and who were warm and welcoming. And in that way, really inviting to those around them. We haven't even talked about this so far in this episode, but this world in which people are terrified about saying or doing the wrong thing because they'll be alienated and ostracized, it's not a fun world to live in for anyone, regardless of their politics. Mm-hmm. And so if Christians can have a warm and welcoming alternative, which means not just being hyper-judgmental, but actually welcoming people who may be at a very different place morally than you and your family are.
Right.
And really be affirming and welcoming of them and their person, that really does work. And we know it works because it's worked historically and it's worked repeatedly historically.
Yes.
That welcoming them into this Catholic vision of reality and helping them to see the world through those eyes, not just in a, let me tell you why you're wrong and need to change your life, but like, let me show you another way of living that's way warmer and friendlier and more affirming of your dignity as a human being. That kind of thing actually works. And that really does change hearts and minds. And it's not going to be us hiding in the woods. And it's not going to be us conforming to the secular world. It's going to be a third thing in which we really transform the world person by person.
But that way seems really hard, Joe.
And that's why
really
the first two ways are simply easier. They really are.
Yeah.
But they're not what we're called to by Christ.
Thanks, Joe. I really appreciate the conversation. Thank you very much. Thanks for joining us on Catholic Answers Focus. We're always happy when you do. If you've got something you'd like to convey to us, you can always send it to our email address, focus@catholic.com, focus@catholic.com. If you're watching on YouTube, if you're listening wherever on some podcast medium,
then you're already tainted by the world.
Right, you are, but we're helping you get out of that. Go ahead and if you would, give us a nice review, maybe share it with others and hit those 5 stars, all of those, the bell, whatever the thing is, wherever you're doing your thing. It would be really helpful. We really are trying to grow the podcast, and your help is very, very welcome. Your financial help is always welcome. GiveCatholic.com is the place to go if you'd like to support us financially. GiveCatholic.com, and that's about it. We'll see you next time, God willing, right here on Catholic Answers Focus.